Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. For the present, my answers are posted every other week on Mondays, and Dr. Yaron Brook answers questions on current events on the alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off at the end, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Shouldn't the sophist's view of ethics properly be called whim-worshipping or nihilism, since fundamentally, egoism is acting in accordance with one's greatest value, necessarily entailing constant thought? No, no, and no. Well, I'll give you one yes. The sophist's view is you act according to your feeling. It's not to be analyzed or doesn't have to be analyzed. If you want it, that makes it good. So that is the definition of whim worshiping. It is not nihilism. Nihilism did not ever exist in Western civilization until Kant. Nihilism is not do whatever you feel, but feel and do a specific thing, namely destroy the good, destroy values. So James Joyce, evil is not that he feels like writing that way, that it would be just whim worship. The evil is he wants to destroy literature, destroy punctuation, destroy story, destroy hero, wipe out the form. Nihilism comes from Latin nihil or nihil, which means nothing. And it's a person who wants not to express an arbitrary emotion, but to wipe out a feel, to wipe out usually something that people like. So it's a step toward wiping out civilization, which concept was initiated by Kant and which is carried out by some president for the first time in American history. I'll let you try to guess which president. Now this person goes on, egoism is acting in accordance with one's greatest value. No, it is not. It entirely depends what your greatest value is. If your greatest value is harming yourself or harming others and thereby harming yourself indirectly, that is not egoism. That is the pursuit of self-destruction. Egoism is acting in accordance with oneself as the highest value, the ultimate beneficiary for which everything else is pursued. Everybody's got some value. I mean, unless they're just eclectic, they've got some value that's greater than others. What about if our greatest value is joining the Peace Corps and digging roads in Mongolia? That is not egoism. It's not egoism just because you feel like it. You know, they used to have a conundrum in philosophy called psychological egoism, which was everybody loves his own pleasure, and that's all he really wants. And you would come back to the person and say, how can you say that? What about the medieval saints who lay in the streets, drank laundry water, tried to make themselves as miserable as possible in the name of God? And then the person comes back and says, well, that's their pleasure. What then does pleasure mean? Anything you want is your pleasure. That's an empty statement. Everybody, I could say, wants grapefruit. I say, what about this person who wants banana? And the answer is, that's his grapefruit. So it's completely wrong to say that this first part. Now, then it goes on with one's greatest value necessarily entails constant thought. Why in the world? If your greatest value is anti-reality and anti-self, why does that entail any thought? Just the thought that you hate these things and want to destroy them. Or just the thought that you don't give a damn what's required. It's too much work. Or just the thought that people won't like you. If you create or define a greatest value, even if it's rational, that would entail thought, if you intend to be rational in the pursuit of it. But if the destruction of the Jewish race or the Jewish people by Hitler does not entail constant thought. It entails military strategy and a monstrous nihilism. So the terms in this question are all mixed up, all wrong. Now, here's a correction, which I guess I deserve. I said in a podcast recently that Obama's agenda has not yet come to fruition, or words to that effect. That's a big statement. Would you please expand on it in a future podcast? Well, if you take those words clearly in the context I gave them, I'm saying, in effect, he is the worst person in the world. You know, when he gets to the full of his capacity, he will outdo everyone. And if I think of that and I ask myself, what is the standard beyond personal hatred based on, you know, 4,003 acts of his, I would objectively say there are three categories of corrupt people in the historic context, and he is in the middle. The worst is the philosopher who makes all other corruption on a social level possible. And in this context, of course, it's Kant and his philosophy. So no one can equal his evil, no matter what they do, because he opened the door to all of it. Now, second would have to be the person who takes a free or semi-free country and translates it, we're still within a peaceful framework, in such a way that the citizens, instead of wanting individual rights and being civilized, are open to and imbued with increasingly conflict, hatred of other groups, the desire to march in the streets and curse them, and nurturing the desire to kill, with the attack on all the agencies that would keep the peace, such as the police and such as the military. Now, on that state, that is exactly what Obama has done. He has taken a relatively free country and opened it up into becoming a totalitarian state, knocking down so much of the Constitution, so much of this distinctively American tradition, that it is ready. A lot of people in this country are ready to start behaving the way they did in Germany just before Hitler. In that sense, I say he's the second. He wouldn't have been possible without Kant. But what's going to come, if it comes, wouldn't have been possible with what he did to America. And that is the outright accession to power of killers. Obama didn't kill anybody, so far as we know. He just opened the door to it. But then next comes the killers, Hitler, Stalin, whichever it happens to be. And now you get the actual mass destruction. And I think those are the three categories. Who is the worst of these three? Well, you can look at it two different ways. The one that unleashed it all, namely Kant, is the worst. Or you can go the other way and say, one is just talk, but the other is the actual, the third is the actual destruction, the actual mass murder. And murder is worse than talk. So it's this conundrum. Which is worse? The man who's talking lets the killers out of jail, or the killers out of jail killing everybody? I think in the context that I understand, I would say Kant is the worst because he makes it all possible. And if you accept that framework, then you'd have to say Obama is in the middle category. Could you explain exactly why you like Michelangelo's The Dying Slave so much, as against The David, which is much more popular among sculpture lovers and has been from the very beginning? Now, let me say at the outset, I am not an authority on any art. I have informed views on literature, and that's it. The rest is just what I respond to. I've never really studied them. So you can discard my answer before I give it. But what I will say is that what I see in The Dying Slave is a specific mood of man. In The David, you see the perfect man, the hero. And of course, I wouldn't in one instant put that down. When I went to Florence, there's huge lines. I got to the front of the line and I immediately lay down on the floor. and then just watched for 10 or 15 minutes and then inched till I went all around it. So, you know, I'm not putting that down in the slightest way. It's just that the dying slave, to me, represents man in a specific mood, which I think is a great mood. And to be blunt about it, to me, it represents man right after sex, right after orgasmic fulfillment. To me, I see someone reveling in the power and enjoyment of his body with his head back that way. Now, the thing around him is supposed to be the ropes, but to me, as someone put in my mind very young, that that's his T-shirt, which is all that was left after his action. But what I get from it is the joy in feeling within himself, within his physical body. And I think that's great. I mean, I'd like to be a hero like the David, but I certainly settle for that feeling. By the way, I discussed this once with Marianne Suries, who's my aesthetic authority, and she went over the whole statue with me and showed what muscle means what. And she found one muscle in the dying slave which is incompatible with what I said. So I have to, I can't name the muscle because I don't know. I know biceps, that's about it. I have to say, this is my view, being ignorant of the muscle that interferes with it. Is anyone born evil? Answer quickly, no, by definition. Evil implies choice. If one wild animal in the desert leaps on another innocent one and rips him to pieces, that is not evil. He has no choice given a sensory stimuli going after him. And then he goes on, if not, are evil people like Jeffrey Dahmer, that's the one that I think had killed a whole bunch of young men that he had or was going to have sexual relationships with. That was long ago. But he's a mass murderer, in fact. Are evil people like Jeffrey Dahmer products of the premises and ideas they've embraced? Yes, I say. Yes. He, like any human being, is a product of the ideas that he's embraced consciously or otherwise. Then he says, well, if so, what do you make of the claims of scientists who say they can identify psychopaths by age 6? Well, there's no problem between that and free will. Basic premises can go back very early. They can go back to 2 and 3. You can see some clearly basic premises. You can see kids of 3 who like to smash, say, take a rock and smash some living creature, like a cat, for instance. They get pleasure out of this. This does not mean they're determined to be that way. It means they've developed already by that age a certain hatred for life, perhaps a jealousy, perhaps the desire for revenge, which they can't distinguish the object of. It is not philosophic determinism. Now, if you found a baby came out of the womb, picked up the nurse's scalpel and stabbed her in the chest, I say, there's something different about that baby than this kid at the age of 6. But I don't know of kids who do that. If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's 2 most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.